Chapter 19. Mika who? The media had unlocked the value of Donald Trump, but few in the media had unlocked it more directly and personally than Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Their MSNBC breakfast show was an ongoing soap opera-ish or possibly Oprah-esque drama about their relationship with Trump, how he had disappointed them, how far they had come from their original regard for him, and how much and how pathetically he regularly embarrassed himself. The bond he once had with them, forged through mutual celebrity and a shared proprietary sense of politics. Scarborough, the former congressman, seemed to feel that he ought reasonably to be president as much as Donald Trump felt he should be, had distinguished the show during the campaign. Now its public fraying became part of the daily news cycle. Scarborough and Brzezinski lectured him, channeled the concerns of his friends and family, upbraided him, and openly worried about him, that he was getting the wrong advice, Bannon, and, two, that his mental powers were slipping. They also staked a claim at representing the reasonable center-right alternative to the president, and indeed were quite a good barometer of both the center-right's efforts to deal with him and its day-to-day difficulties of living with him. Trump, believing he had been used and abused by Scarborough and Brzezinski, claimed he'd stopped watching the show, but Hope Hicks, every morning, quaking, had to recount it for him. Morning Joe was a ground zero study in the way the media had over-invested in Trump. He was the whale against which media emotions, self-regard, ego, joie de guerre, career advancement, and desire to be at the center of the story, too, all churned in nearly ecstatic obsession. In reverse regard, the media was the same whale serving the same function for Trump. To this, Trump added another tick, a lifelong sense that people were constantly taking unfair advantage of him. This perhaps came from his father's cheapness and lack of generosity, or from his own over-awareness of being a rich kid, and no doubt his insecurities about this, or from a negotiator's profound understanding that it is never win-win, that where there is profit, there is loss. Trump simply could not abide the knowledge that somebody was getting a leg up at his expense. His was a zero-sum ecosystem. In the world of Trump, anything that he deemed of value either accrued to him or had been robbed from him. Scarborough and Brzezinski had taken their relationship with Trump and amply monetized it while putting no percentage in his pocket. And in this instance, he judged his commission should be slavishly favorable treatment. To say this drove him mad would be an understatement. He dwelled and fixated on the perceived injustice. Don't mention Joe or Mika to him was a standing prescription. His wounded feelings and incomprehension at the failure of people whose embrace he sought to, in return, embrace him was deep, crazy deep, said his former aide, Sam Nunberg, who had run afoul of his need for 100% approbation and his bitter suspicion of being profited from. Out of this accumulated rage came his June 29th tweet about Mika Brzezinski. It was classic Trump. There was no mediation between off-the-record language and the public statement. Referring to low-IQ crazy Mika in one tweet, he wrote in another that she was bleeding badly from a facelift when she and Scarborough visited Trump at Mar-a-Lago on the previous New Year's Eve. Many of his tweets were not, as they might seem, spontaneous utterances, but constant ones. Trump's rifts often began as insult comedy and solidified as bitter accusations, and then, in an uncontainable moment, became an official proclamation. The next step in his tweet paradigm was universal liberal opprobrium. Almost a week of social media fury, cable breastbeating, and front-page condemnation followed his tweet about Brzezinski. That was accompanied by the other part of the Trump tweet dynamic. By unifying liberal opinion against him, he unified its opposite for him. In truth, he was often neither fully aware of the nature of what he had said, nor fully cognizant of why there should be such a passionate reaction to it. As often as not, he surprised himself "What did I say?" he would ask after getting severe blowback. He wasn't serving up these insults for effect, well, not entirely. And his behavior wasn't carefully calculated. It was tit for tat, and he likely would have said what he'd said even if no one was left standing with him. This very lack of calculation, this inability to be political, was part of his political charm. It was just his good luck that the Trumpian 35%, that standing percentage of people who, according to most polls, seemed to support him no matter what, who would, in his estimation, let him get away with shooting someone on Fifth Avenue, was largely unfazed and maybe even buoyed by every new expression of Trumpness. Now, having expressed himself and gotten in the last word, Trump was cheery again. "Mika and Joe totally love this. It's big ratings for them," said the president, with certain satisfaction and obvious truth. 10 days later, a large table of Bannonites was having dinner at the Bombay Club, a high-end Indian restaurant 2 blocks from the White House. One of the group, Arthur Schwartz, a PR consultant, asked a question about the Mika and Joe affair. Perhaps it was the noise, but it was also a fitting measure of the speed of events in the Trump era. Bannon Lieutenant Alexandra Preet replied with genuine fogginess, "Who?" The operetta of the Mika tweets, the uncouthness and verbal abuse demonstrated by the president, his serious lack of control and judgment, and the worldwide censure heaped upon him for it, had already far receded, wholly overshadowed by more Trump eruptions and controversy. But before moving on to the next episode of Oh My Godness, it is worth considering the possibility that this constant, daily, often more than once a day pileup of events, each one canceling out the one before, is the true aberration and novelty at the heart of the Trump presidency. Perhaps never before in history, not through world wars, the overthrow of empires, periods of extraordinary social transformation, or episodes of government-shaking scandal, have real-life events unfolded with such emotional and plot-thickening impact. In the fashion of binge-watching a television show, one's real life became quite secondary to the public drama. It was not unreasonable to say, "Whoa, wait just a minute, public life doesn't happen like this." Public life, in fact, lacks coherence and drama. History, by contrast, attains coherence and drama only in hindsight. The process of accomplishing the smallest set of tasks within the sprawling and resistant executive branch is a turtle process. The burden of the White House is the boredom of bureaucracy. All White Houses struggle to rise above that, and they succeed only on occasion. In the age of hypermedia, this has not gotten easier for the White House. It's gotten harder. It's a distracted nation, fragmented and preoccupied. It was, arguably, the peculiar tragedy of Barack Obama that even as a transformational figure and inspirational communicator, he couldn't really command much interest. As well, it might be a central tragedy of the news media that its old-fashioned and even benighted civic-minded belief that politics is the highest form of news has helped transform it from a mass business to a narrow-cast one. Alas, politics itself has more and more become a discreet business. Its appeal is B2B, business to business. The real swamp is the swamp of insular, inbred, incestuous interests. This isn't corruption so much as overspecialization. It's a wonk's life. Politics has gone one way, the culture another. The left-right junkies might pretend otherwise, but the great middle doesn't put political concerns at the top of their minds. And yet, contravening all cultural and media logic, Donald Trump produced on a daily basis an astonishing, can't-stop-following-it narrative. And this was not even because he was changing or upsetting the fundamentals of American life. In 6 months as president, failing to master almost any aspect of the bureaucratic process, he had, beyond placing his nominee on the Supreme Court, accomplished, practically speaking, nothing. And yet, OMG! There almost was no other story in America, and in much of the world. That was the radical and transformational nature of the Trump presidency. It held everybody's attention. Inside the White House, the daily brouhaha and world's fascination was no cause for joy. It was, in the White House staff's bitter view, the media that turned every day into a climactic, dastardly moment. And in a sense, this was correct. Every development cannot be climactic. The fact that yesterday's climax would soon, compared to the next climax, be piddling, rather bore out the disproportion. The media was failing to judge the relative importance of Trump events. Most Trump events came to naught. Arguably, all of them did. And yet all were greeted with equal shock and horror. The White House staff believed that the media's Trump coverage lacked context. By this, they meant that people ought to realize that Trump was mostly just huffing and puffing. At the same time, few in the White House did not assign blame to Trump for this as well. He seemed to lack the most basic understanding that a president's words and actions would necessarily be magnified to the nth power. In some convenient sense, he failed to understand this because he wanted the attention, no matter how often it disappointed him. But he also wanted it because again and again the response surprised him. And, as though every time was the first time, he could not modify his behavior. Sean Spicer caught the brunt of the daily drama, turning this otherwise reasonable, mild-mannered, process-oriented professional into a joke figure standing at the White House door. In his daily out-of-body experience, as a witness to his own humiliation and loss for words, Spicer understood after a while, although he began to understand this beginning his first day on the job when dealing with the dispute about the inaugural audience numbers, that he had gone down a rabbit hole. In this disorienting place, all public artifice, pretense, proportion, savvy, and self-awareness had been cast off. Or, possibly another result of Trump never really intending to be president, never really figured into the state of being president. On the other hand, constant hysteria did have one unintended political virtue. If every new event canceled out every other event, like some wacky news cycle pyramid scheme, then you always survived another day. Donald Trump's sons, Don Jr., 39, and Eric, 33, existed in an enforced infantile relationship to their father, a role that embarrassed them, but one that they also professionally embraced. The role was to be Donald Trump's heirs and attendees. Their father took some regular pleasure in pointing out that they were in the back of the room when God handed out brains, but then again, Trump tended to scorn anyone who might be smarter than he was. Their sister Ivanka, certainly no native genius, was the designated family smart person, her husband Jared, the family's smooth operator. That left Don and Eric to errands and admin. In fact, the brothers had grown into reasonably competent family-owned company executives. This is not saying all that much, because their father had little or no patience for actually running his company. Of course, quite a good amount of their professional time was spent on the whims, projects, promotions, and general way of life of DJT. One benefit of their father's run for president was that it kept him away from the office. Still, the campaign's administration was largely their responsibility, so when the campaign went from caprice to a serious development in the Trump business and family, it caused a disruption in the family dynamic. Other people were suddenly eager to be Donald Trump's key lieutenants. There were the outsiders, like Corey Lewandowski, the campaign manager. But there was also the insider, brother-in-law Jared. Trump, not unusually for a family-run company, made everybody compete for his favor. The company was about him. It existed because of his name, personality, and charisma, so the highest standing in the company was reserved for those who could best serve him. There wasn't all that much competition for this role before he ran for president. But in early 2016, with the Republican Party collapsing and Trump rising, his sons faced a new professional and family situation. Their brother-in-law had been slowly drawn into the campaign, partly at his wife's urging because her father's lack of constraint might actually affect the Trump business if they didn't keep an eye on him. And then he, with his brothers-in-law, was pulled in by the excitement of the campaign itself. By late spring 2016, when the nomination was all but clinched, the Trump campaign was a set of competing power centers with the knives out. Lewandowski regarded both brothers and their brother-in-law with rolling-on-the-floor contempt. Not only were Don Jr. and Eric stupid, and Jared somehow both supercilious and obsequious, the butler, but nobody knew a whit about politics. Indeed, there wasn't an hour of political experience among them. As time went on, Lewandowski became particularly close to the candidate. To the family, especially to Kushner, Lewandowski was an enabler. Trump's worst instincts flowed through Lewandowski. In early June, a little more than a month before the Republican National Convention, Jared and Ivanka decided that what was needed for the sake of the campaign, for the sake of the Trump business, was an intervention. Making common cause with Don Jr. and Eric, Jared and Ivanka pushed for a united front to convince Trump to oust Lewandowski. Don Jr., feeling squeezed not only by Lewandowski, but by Jared, too, seized the opportunity. He would push out Lewandowski and become his replacement. And indeed, 11 days later, Lewandowski would be gone. All this was part of the background to one of the most preposterous meetings in modern politics. On June 9th, 2016, Don Jr., Jared, and Paul Manafort met with a movie-worthy cast of dubious characters in Trump Tower after having been promised damaging information about Hillary Clinton. Don Jr., encouraged by Jared and Ivanka, was trying to impress his father that he had the stuff to rise in the campaign. When this meeting became public 13 months later, it would, for the Trump White House, encapsulate both the case against collusion with the Russians and the case for it. It was a case, or the lack of one, not of masterminds and subterfuge, but of senseless and benighted people so guileless and unconcerned that they enthusiastically colluded in plain sight. Walking into Trump Tower that June day were a well-connected lawyer from Moscow, who was a likely Russian agent, associates of the Azerbaijani Russian oligarch Aras Agalarov, a U.S. music promoter who managed Agalarov's son, a Russian pop star, and a Russian government lobbyist in Washington. Their purpose in visiting the campaign headquarters of a presumptive major party nominee for president of the United States was to meet with three of the most highly placed people on the campaign. This meeting was preceded by an email chain addressed to multiple recipients inside the Trump campaign of almost joyful intent. The Russians were offering a dump of negative or even incriminating information about their opponent. Among the why and how theories of this imbecilic meeting, the Russians, in organized or freelance fashion, were trying to entrap the Trump campaign into a compromising relationship. The meeting was part of an already active cooperation on the part of the Trump campaign with the Russians to obtain and distribute damaging information about Hillary Clinton. And indeed, within days of the Don Jr. meeting, WikiLeaks announced that it had obtained Clinton emails. Less than a month later, it started to release them. The wide-eyed Trump campaign, largely still play-acting at running for president, and with no thought whatsoever of actually winning the election, was open to any and all entreaties and offers, because it had nothing to lose. Dopey Don Jr., Fredo, as Steve Bannon would dub him in one of his frequent Godfather borrowings, was simply trying to prove he was a player and a go-to guy. The meeting included the campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, and the campaign's most influential voice, Jared Kushner, because A, high-level conspiracy was being coordinated, B, Manafort and Kushner, not taking the campaign very seriously and without a thought of any consequence here, were merely entertained by the possibility of dirty tricks. C, the three men were united in their plan to get rid of Lewandowski, with Don Jr. as the hatchet man, and, as part of this unity, Manafort and Kushner need to show up at Don Jr.'s silly meeting. Whatever the reason for the meeting, no matter which of the above scenarios most accurately describes how this comical and alarming group came together, a year later, practically nobody doubted that Don Jr. would have wanted his father to know that he seized the initiative. The chance that Don Jr. did not walk these Jumos up to his father's office on the 26th floor is zero. said an astonished and derisive Bannon, not long after the meeting was revealed. "The three senior guys in the campaign," an incredulous Bannon went on, "thought it was a good idea to meet with a foreign government inside Trump Tower in the conference room on the 25th floor with no lawyers. They didn't have any lawyers. Even if you thought that this was not treasonous or unpatriotic or bad shit, and I happen to think it's all of that, you should have called the FBI immediately. Even if you didn't think to do that, and you're totally amoral, and you wanted that information, you do it in a Holiday Inn in Manchester, New Hampshire, with your lawyers who meet with these people and go through everything, and then they verbally come and tell another lawyer in a cutout. And if you've got something, then you figure out how to dump it down to Breitbart or something like that, or maybe some other more legitimate publication. You never see it, you never know it, because you don't need to. But that's the brain trust that they had." All of the participants would ultimately plead that the meeting was utterly inconsequential, whatever the hope for it might have been, and admit that it was hapless. But even if that was true, a year later, the revelation of the meeting had three profound and probably transformational effects. First, the constant, ever-repeated denials about there having been no discussion between campaign officials and the Russians connected to the Kremlin about the campaign, and indeed no meaningful contact between campaign officials and the Russian government, were exploded. Second, the certainty among the White House staff that Trump himself would have not only been apprised of the details of this meeting, but have met the principals, meant that the president was caught out as a liar by those whose trust he most needed. It was another inflection point between hunkered down in the bunker and signed on for the wild ride and get me out of here. Third, it was now starkly clear that everyone's interests diverged. The fortunes of Don Jr., Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner hung individually in the balance. Indeed, the best guess by many in the West Wing was that the details of the meeting had been leaked by the Kushner side, thus sacrificing Don Jr. in an attempt to deflect responsibility away from themselves. Even before word of the June 2016 meeting leaked out, Kushner's legal team, largely assembled in a rush since the appointment of Mueller, the special counsel, had been piecing together a forensic picture of both the campaign's Russian contacts and Kushner Company's finances and money trail. In January, ignoring almost everybody's caution against it, Jared Kushner had entered the White House as a senior figure in the administration. Now, 6 months later, he faced acute legal jeopardy. He had tried to keep a low profile, seeing himself as a behind-the-scenes counselor. But now his public position was not only endangering himself, but the future of his family's business. As long as he remained exposed, his family was effectively blocked from most financial sources. Without access to this market, their holdings risked becoming distressed debt situations. Jared and Ivanka's self-created fantasy-like life, two ambitious, well-mannered, well-liked young people living at the top of New York's social and financial world after having, in their version of humble fashion, accepted global power, had now, even with neither husband nor wife in office long enough to have taken any real action at all, come to the precipice of disgrace. Jail was possible. So was bankruptcy. Trump may have been talking defiantly about offering pardons or bragging about his power to give them, but that did not solve Kushner's business problems, nor did it provide a way to mollify Charlie Kushner, Jared's choleric and often irrational father. What's more, successfully navigating through the eye of the legal needle would require a careful touch and nuanced strategic approach on the part of the president. Quite an unlikely development. Meanwhile, the couple blamed everyone else in the White House. They blamed Priebus for the disarray that had produced a warlike atmosphere that propelled constant and damaging leaks. They blamed Bannon for leaking, and they blamed Spicer for poorly defending their virtue and interests. They needed to defend themselves. One strategy was to get out of town, Bannon had a list of all the tense moments when the couple had taken a convenient holiday, and it happened that Trump would be attending the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany, on July 7th and 8th. Jared and Ivanka accompanied the president on the trip, and while at the summit, they learned that word of Don Jr.'s meeting with the Russians, and the couple kept pointedly presenting it as Don Jr.'s meeting, had leaked. Worse, they learned that the story was about to break in the New York Times. Originally, Trump's staff was expecting details of the Don Jr. meeting to break on the website Circa. The lawyers and spokesperson, Mark Carallo, had been working to manage this news. But while in Hamburg, the president's staff learned that the Times was developing a story that had far more details about the meeting, quite possibly supplied by the Kushner side, which it would publish on Saturday, July 8th. Advance knowledge of this article was kept from the president's legal team for the ostensible reason that it didn't involve the president. In Hamburg, Ivanka, knowing the news would shortly get out, was presenting her signature effort, a World Bank fund to aid women entrepreneurs in developing countries. This was another instance of what White House staffers saw as the couple's extraordinarily off-message direction. Nowhere in the Trump campaign, nowhere on Bannon's whiteboards, nowhere in the heart of this president was there an interest in women entrepreneurs in developing countries. The daughter's agenda was singularly at odds with the father's, or at least the agenda that had elected him. Ivanka, in the view of almost every White House staffer, profoundly misunderstood the nature of her job and had converted traditional first lady noblesse oblige efforts into White House staff work. Shortly before boarding Air Force One for the return trip home, Ivanka, with what by now was starting to seem like an almost anarchic tone deafness, sat in for her father between Chinese President Xi Jinping and British Prime Minister Theresa May at the main G20 conference table. But this was mere distraction. As the president and his team huddled on the plane, the central subject was not the conference. It was how to respond to the Times story about Don Jr.'s and Jared's Trump Tower meeting, now only hours away from breaking. En route to Washington, Sean Spicer and everybody else from the communications office was relegated to the back of the plane and excluded from the panicky discussions. Hope Hicks became the senior communications strategist, with the president, as always, her singular client. In the days following, that highest political state of being in the room was turned on its head. Not being in the room, in this case the forward cabin on Air Force One, became an exalted status and get-out-of-jail-free card. "It used to hurt my feelings when I saw them running around doing things that were my job," said Spicer. "Now, I'm glad to be out of the loop." Included in the discussion on the plane were the president, Hicks, Jared and Ivanka, and their spokesperson, Josh Raffel. Ivanka, according to the later recollection of her team, would shortly leave the meeting, take a pill, and go to sleep. Jared, in the telling of his team, might have been there, but he was not taking a pencil to anything. Nearby, in a small conference room, watching the movie Fargo, were Dina Powell, Gary Cohn, Stephen Miller, and H.R. McMaster, all of whom would later insist that they were, however physically close to the unfolding crisis, removed from it. And indeed, anyone in the room was caught in a moment that would shortly receive the special counsel's close scrutiny, with the relevant question being whether one or more federal employees had induced other federal employees to lie. An aggrieved, unyielding, and threatening president dominated the discussion, pushing into line his daughter and her husband, Hicks and Raffel. Kasowitz, the lawyer whose specific job was to keep Trump at arm's length from Russia-related matters, was kept on hold on the phone for an hour and then not put through. The president insisted that the meeting in Trump Tower was purely and simply about Russian adoption policy. That's what was discussed, period. Period. Even though it was likely, if not certain, that the Times had the incriminating email chain, in fact, it was quite possible that Jared and Ivanka and the lawyers knew the Times had this email chain, the president ordered that no one should let on to the more problematic discussion about Hillary Clinton. It was a real-time example of denial and cover-up, The president believed, belligerently, what he believed. Reality was what he was convinced it was, or should be. Hence the official story. There was a brief courtesy meeting in Trump Tower about adoption policy, to no result, attended by senior aides and unaffiliated Russian nationals. The crafting of this manufactured tale was a rogue operation by rookies, always the two most combustible elements of a cover-up. In Washington, Kasowitz and the legal team spokesperson, Mark Carallo, weren't informed of either the Times article or the plan for how to respond to it until Don Jr.'s initial statement went out just before the story broke that Saturday. Over the course of the next 72 hours or so, the senior staff found itself wholly separated from, and, once again, looking on in astonishment at, the actions of the president's innermost circle of aides. In this, the relationship of the president and Hope Hicks, long tolerated as a quaint bond between the older man and a trustworthy young woman, began to be seen as anomalous and alarming. Completely devoted to accommodating him, she, his media facilitator, was the ultimate facilitator of unmediated behavior. His impulses and thoughts, unedited, unreviewed, unchallenged, not only passed through him, but, via Hicks, traveled out into the world without any other White House arbitration. "The problem isn't Twitter, it's Hope," observed one communications staffer. On July 9th, a day after publishing its first story, The Times noted that the Trump Tower meeting was specifically called to discuss the Russian offer of damaging material about Clinton. The next day, as the Times prepared to publish the full email chain, Don Jr. hurriedly dumped it himself. There followed an almost daily count of new figures, all in their own way, peculiar and unsettling, who emerged as participants in the meeting. But the revelation of the Trump Tower meeting had another, perhaps even larger dimension. It marked the collapse of the president's legal strategy, the demise of Steve Bannon's Clinton-emulating firewall around the president. The lawyers, in disgust and alarm, saw in effect each principal becoming a witness to another principal's potential misdeeds, all conspiring with one another to get their stories straight. The client and his family were panicking and running their own defense. Short-term headlines were overwhelming any sort of long-term strategy. "The worst thing you can do is lie to a prosecutor," said one member of the legal team. The persistent Trump idea that it is not a crime to lie to the media was regarded by the legal team as at best reckless and in itself potentially actionable, an explicit attempt to throw sand into the investigation's gears. Mark Carallo was instructed not to speak to the press, indeed not to even answer his phone. Later that week, Carallo, seeing no good outcome, and privately confiding that he believed the meeting on Air Force One represented a likely obstruction of justice, quit. The Gervonka side would put it out that Carallo was fired. "These guys are not going to be second-guessed by the kids," said a frustrated Bannon about the firewall team. Likewise, the Trump family, no matter its legal exposure, was not going to be run by its lawyers. Jared and Ivanka helped to coordinate a set of lurid leaks, alleging drinking, bad behavior, personal life in disarray, about Mark Kasowitz, who had advised the president to send the couple home. Shortly after the presidential party returned to Washington, Kasowitz was out. Blame continued to flow. The odor of a bitter new reality, if not doom, that attached to the Comey-Mueller debacle was compounded by everyone's efforts not to be tagged by it. The sides in the White House, Jared, Ivanka, Hope Hicks, and an increasingly ambivalent Dina Powell and Gary Cohn on one side, and almost everyone else, including Priebus, Spicer, Conway, and most clearly Bannon on the other, were most distinguished by their culpability in or distance from the Comey-Mueller calamity. It was, as the non-Gervonka side would unceasingly point out, a calamity of their own making. Therefore, it became an effort of the Gervonkas not only to achieve distance for themselves from the causes of the debacle, such involvement as they had, they now cast as strictly passive involvement or just following orders, but to suggest that their adversaries were at least equally at fault. Shortly after the Don Jr. story broke, the president not unsuccessfully changed the subject by focusing the blame for the Comey-Mueller mess on Sessions, even more forcefully belittling and threatening him and suggesting that his days were numbered. Bannon, who continued to defend Sessions, and who believed that he had militantly, indeed with scathing attacks on the Gervonkas for their stupidity, walled himself off from the Comey smash-up, was now suddenly getting calls from reporters with leaks that painted him as an engaged participant in the Comey decision. In a furious phone call to Hicks, Bannon blamed the leaks on her. In time, he had come to see the 28-year-old as nothing more than a hapless presidential enabler and poor fish Gervonka flunky. And he believed she had now deeply implicated herself in the entire disaster by participating in the Air Force One meeting. The next day, with more inquiries coming from reporters, he confronted Hicks inside the cabinet room, accusing her of doing Jared and Ivanka's dirty work. The face-off quickly escalated into an existential confrontation between the two sides of the White House, two sides on a total war footing. "You don't know what you're doing," shouted a livid Bannon at Hicks, demanding to know who she worked for, the White House or Jared and Ivanka. "You don't know how much trouble you were in," he screamed, telling her that if she didn't get a lawyer, he would call her father and tell him he had better get her one. "You are dumb as a stone." Moving from the cabinet room across the open area into the president's earshot, a loud, scary, clearly threatening Bannon in the Gervonka telling yelled, "I am going to fuck you and your little group." With a baffled president plaintively wanting to know, "What's going on?" In the Gervonka side account, Hicks then ran from Bannon, hysterically sobbing and visibly terrified. Others in the West Wing marked this as the high point of the boiling enmity between the two sides. For the Gervonkas, Bannon's rant was also a display that they believed they could use against him. The Gervonka people pushed Priebus to refer the matter to the White House counsel, billing this as the most verbally abusive moment in the history of the West Wing, or at least certainly up among the most abusive episodes ever. For Bannon, this was just more Gervonka desperation. They were the ones, not him, saddled with Comey Mueller. They were the ones panicking and out of control. For the rest of his time in the White House, Bannon would not speak to Hicks again.